Hey, welcome to the Meat House. Jeff here. My buddy Chris is with me here, having a little snacko because we're about to drink some meat. And, you know, that's...
Yeah, eating with alcohol is just kind of an important thing for us.
We work hard for you guys here.
Yeah, it's a tough job and we get to do it. So, how you doing, everybody? Glad you joined us again. And I want to start off by thanking all of the people who listen to us, all our sponsors, all the people who like, give us feedback. You're letting us know that we're helping them out in any way possible and giving us ideas to do.
Absolutely, because, I mean, yeah. I could hang out with my buddy and drink a meat or two every weekend just for funsies. And I'd probably enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm good with that. But, like, you know, it's good to have you here, too.
We're going through the effort of going through all these different topics, talking and, you know, putting this out on the web for everyone to talk about. The feedback is important. We get to hear about what you guys are interested in. We get to hear about what you think of the stuff we're talking about. And hopefully you guys are finding this useful. I know we talked to a number of you guys, like, you know, oh, this topic was actually really insightful. And, you know, we're stretching a little bit. Like last week we talked about growing berries and stuff, which is, you know, Is it a stretch? A little bit, but we're talking about making really good mead with stuff you grow yourself. So yeah. I don't think it's a huge...
We're not going too far out of our wheelhouse.
Right.
I will tell you, I talked to a gentleman just yesterday at a friend's birthday party. Mm-hmm. He says he is so glad when he sees Renaissance festivals and events come up that have mead, because he's a mechanic and he drinks beer a lot.
Right.
Because he's a mechanic. But he loves mead. It's just so hard to find good mead.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you know, dude, this is a wide open area. If you can make a good mead, there are people who want to meet you.
Right. And like it or not, there are a few liquor stores in the Kansas City area that I know of that have a decent selection of mead.
Really? I'd like to know who they are.
Well, Total Wine over here has a couple
good brands. They have seven.
They have a couple good brands. Okay. And they have like several that are, yeah. You know, the big brands you see, I could name a few, but I don't want to like throw a bunch of shade to, you know, people that are making money and doing their thing.
The industrial grade meads we get at the liquor stores, they're good. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say they're not good. They are good. They're the ones that got me started in what I'm doing now. Without tooting any horn, without any arrogance whatsoever, I can say Jeff and I make much better mead. We really do.
There are some very good meads out there, but you are paying a premium for them at the local liquor store. And realistically, you know, if you go to websites for mead makers, you're traveling around, you taste mead, things you like. Most of the meaderies you see online have like a quarterly mead club. I'm in two of those. There's like a Sap House out of like New Hampshire and Apigard out of Washington. And once a quarter, I get like between two and four bottles from each of them. And I pay for that. But it supports the mead directly. Supports the meadery directly.
Yes.
And you get good quality meads that are, you know, a step above the stuff you're probably finding at your local liquor store. It's you okay, know, again, but it's...
No shade to the ones that you find out there easily.
Mm-hmm.
But they're good. They're established. They're consistent. They're not great meads.
And realistically, if you can find like two or three meads from a single mead maker that you like, chances are you're going to like what they come up with on their quarterly mead thing. That's, mm-hmm. They have their own style. They have their own like little slice of the mead marketplace. And if they've got established enough that they have a mead quarterly, you know, thing, yeah, okay, they're going to be around for a while.
It's like going to a smaller winery.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get a slightly better wine that you like a little bit better simply because they have smaller batch and take care of what they do.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, when I was up in Ohio and in Pennsylvania going to Renaissance Festivals up in the Great Lakes and the Mount Hope Renaissance Festival, just going to the Great Lakes Renaissance Festival from where I was staying was like just under a half hour drive.
Right.
But I went by no less than five vineyards, wineries.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have time to go to all of them.
Right.
And I felt cheated.
Well, and like the south end of town here, there's a solid like little wine trail you can go down. Not only that, like the University of Missouri has a wine program in the south part of the state. That's just like the mid to south part of the state. As you get like into the Ozark Plateau, there's so much wine growing there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, is it the, you know, like, California wine country, Napa Valley?
The answer is yes.
Pretty close.
Yeah. The answer is shockingly, yeah. People say France and Italy and California are wines. The growing climate in Kansas, Missouri, middle America is closer to French than you'd believe. And we have had wines come out of this part of the country that took awards in international competition. People say, "Well, where did you get this from? France. Where did you get this? Kansas, Missouri." And you'd see their brain melt.
Quality is there, the notoriety is not.
Yeah. And so we're trying to help you make a better mead, one you can enjoy, one you can share.
And hey, speaking of the mead clubs I'm a part of, our mead that we're tasting is this is from Sap House. This is one of their experimentals. This is 24-010. This is a smoked pineapple and habanero, and I forget exactly how long ago I got this, but this is a nice, like, medium to dark amber, I would say.
A little lighter than last week's, but not bad. It's
Yeah.
a little closer to straw than amber.
Yeah. And again, it's a medium, not a dark. It has the pineapple on that is
It's white right up there. Right up
beautiful.
there. I got my face so far in the cup, I splashed my mouth with the mead. Oh my God. Well, tasty, but
The hazards of tasting.
oh, messy. Okay, here. Clean that up. But I don't smell the pepper.
No, and I'm getting into the habanero. I'm sorry, getting into the tasting part of it. The habanero doesn't really come off as a flavor so much as like there's a little bit of heat on the back end. That's just a tingle. It's really not pronounced at all.
Oh, good.
It's kind of
Thank you for that, because
this is
I
a
was scared.
yeah. I wasn't too worried about Sap House throwing a super spicy one like the mystery mead that we had 2 or 3 episodes in here.
Oh, one of our first episodes. Yeah, that was, oh my gosh, I still have nightmares about that.
Yeah, it's just kind of a lingering tingle at the back of your tongue. But that pineapple, oh damn. And I wouldn't mind a little more smoke on that, but the pineapple itself is really true to form. It's a really pronounced flavor.
I like that. I mean, yeah, and Jeff was absolutely right. I mean, anybody who saw the early episodes of our podcast or know spices almost cripplingly debilitating to me. I would curl up in a little ball and leave the world. This is nice. This is it, just like you said, it's a nice tingle in the back of the tongue without being horribly spicy. It does not overpower the pineapple.
Right.
Pineapple is still the predominant, but this is good.
Like I think we talked about before, there are basically two different approaches to adding spicy to a mead. There's the I'm going to prank my friends and make them drink something terrible and punch them in the face or kick them in the balls.
And then pay the consequences later.
Right. Or there's I think what they're doing here, which is adding it as like a tertiary or an ancillary flavor. I'm not even calling it secondary because I think like the honey and the pineapple are playing more of a role here than the spice, but it's just a little something extra that adds a little je ne sais quoi, if we want to be
I don't know what that is.
shut up.
Yeah, of course. Sorry. Sorry. Anyway,
Go stand in your corner, Chris.
where are we? Anyway, but no, I'm as a person who doesn't handle spice really well, this is drinkable.
This is,
This isn't bad at all. I
if
mean,
I'm going to put pepper in a mead, this is the level of pepper I want in a mead. Just a little something.
it's a little above warming, but not excessively.
Yeah, it's a little tingle, and I think the habanero, and especially if you watch like the what do I want to say, like the YouTube videos about like making hot sauce or like salsa and stuff like that, different peppers have different like notes above and beyond their heat. Like I like habanero, I like Scotch bonnet as far as like their flavor profiles. They play nicely with citrusy bright tropical fruits.
Excellent. I'll take your word for that
Yeah,
because I
so
can't eat a hot pepper and know what I'm tasting.
fair. But I think this is the approach to it, where you just add a little bit of the flavor to get some of that warmth, that the tingle to it.
A little bit of pop to the overall flavor. It elevates it just a smidge to make it notable.
No, I think this is really nicely done, and I can't count how many times I've sung Sap House's praises, but this is you're probably. You listening at home are probably getting a little tired of
No, I doubt it because if you can consistently sing the praises of any meadery, they've got something going. And it's something you should check out. I mean, there are not a whole lot of meaderies here in the Midwest.
No, there really aren't.
However, on the coasts, when I went to Pennsylvania, I could not get away from the conversation of meaderies. I just simply couldn't because, oh, yeah, we had a meadery here and a meadery here and a meadery. I'm sitting here. Well, I'm a little jealous.
Stop, though. I think that depends on your definition of the Midwest. Because you and I are probably thinking like Kansas, Missouri, and maybe Iowa and Nebraska and Oklahoma and Arkansas. You get into like Michigan. Michigan's lousy with meatballs.
Oh, yeah. Michigan's so, a huge amount. And yeah. I need to take that back. That is true. Michigan is awash with meat makers, and I love each and every one of them.
Minnesota, too. There's a lot of them up there. So, yeah, no, it's what part of the Midwest? But around here, yeah, no, we are.
We're kind of shy on them. And I hope that changes in the future. I really do.
We're getting our good meat by UPS.
Yeah, but, you know. I'll take it if I can get it.
Hey, you know who we forgot to thank at the top of the show, though?
We need
to thank Box and Barley
Corn. Yep. Box and Barley Corn is our sponsor. Has been since the beginning. The place has been out for 57 years. Is everything you need for beer, wine, mead, cheese, yogurt.
Kombucha, distilled products.
And all the supplies of mechanical ingredients and knowledge, the instructions, the know-how, the passion of making a outstanding mead, wine, or whatever you're looking for. They are great people. I love Jake. I love his friends. Yeah, here, try this. They'll try it. They'll give you an honest review of it. They'll tell you, they'll give you their critique and how to improve it and what they have at hand to help with that. And if you have something, you know, something you can need to help with and they don't have it, they know how to get it.
Exactly. And, you know, on the topic of, hey, try this. I know a bunch of you guys are not in the Kansas City area, but if you happen to be, you know, shopping at the Boxes of Barley Corn, every time I go in there,
MPH 10.
Yeah. MPH 10 gets you 10% off on your online orders. But for those of you going into the store, they also always have something or other on that kegerator that is pretty goddamn tasty, yep. Whether it's going to be a wine or a beer or a meat or a something.
Just this last week, I went in, they gave me a cider. I could not tell you what the flavoring was, but it was good. You know, my wife and I came in, I need to get some yeast and a few filters. And I got those. I said, you like some cider here? And they, as he's putting it down, would you like some cider? Clink, clink. Well, since it's here, sure, why not? It was delightful. And it's a great family environment. They love their customers. They love the people that come in. Great people.
Yeah, the atmosphere is friendly and inviting, and generally, like, as many times as I've had fun conversations with Jake or the other guys working there, like, the other customers at the bar, I'll end up having a one-off little, oh, yeah, no, I make me do a podcast, and we talk about this, that, and the other. Oh, yeah, here, I brought in this beer I made. Oh, cool. They are part of the community in a way that is, like, so fundamental to, like, what is
important
to me. Yeah.
Is like, important.
Yeah.
And honest to goodness, don't go in there for a, you know, I'm going to grab this and leave thing. You're not going to make it. You're going to be there a while. I mean, I think the best I've done so far is half hour stay. And I went to get, and that was the last one I did. I went to get filters and some yeast and a flavoring for my son for licorice.
Yep.
He wanted to make a licorice mead. And I went in there and I got those, I put them on the counter, and I stayed. And, you know, Jake, they have chairs there, you know, to just sit there and stay.
I've known you for almost 20 years now, and I still have yet to see you interact with a stranger.
What's that?
Yeah, exactly.
What's that?
You're a friendly guy. Anybody engages you in conversation, you will jump on that.
Oh, yeah. Even a few that don't.
But hey, once again, Meadhouse 10, MHP 10 is our discount code. You go to Boxes of Barley Corn's website. You can use our code, let them know that you're listening, that you're appreciating them sponsoring us, and you can save yourself 10% off top.
Yeah, win-win, and we appreciate it. And they let us know, lets them know that we are reaching out.
Right, exactly. So
thank you so much for Boxes of Barley Corn and on what we're doing here. Now, other than our meat of the day, this delightful, actually, and this is an odd thing for me to say, mm-hmm. A pineapple habanero I'm enjoying, mm-hmm. And that's something I never thought would come out of my mouth. There's another one you made recently,
yeah,
from our meat house that we put online for the show.
Right. Our meat house 8%, an age and a day ago. I started this, and I got a little, you know, set back and didn't quite get as fast as I wanted to, but this is what I've done with my, like, test brew of my 8% recipe after I kind of went, okay, well, I know this works. I know this is good.
And now, man, you can do this too.
Oh,
not
yes.
Just the way you've done it here, but you can put your own spin on it. So,
yeah, no.
Take this as a lesson of what you can do.
Right. So, I am calling this, put some seeds in your pocket.
Yes, sir.
If you guys remember, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been going on for a little over 3 years now.
And I will tell you, categorically, I'm in favor of Ukraine.
Yeah, as am I. 2 or 3 days into the invasion, there was a very popular little video floating around the internet of an older woman yelling at Russian invading troops, telling them to put seeds in their pockets so that when they die, something beautiful will come out of it.
So that's where that name came from.
And I kind of looked at that and accepted that that old woman has larger cojones than I do.
Yeah.
And yeah, no.
I bow to her dominance. Yeah, she's awesome.
But sunflowers are the national flower of Ukraine. They're also, you know, the state flower of Kansas. So
strange that, you know, well, that doesn't affect me at all.
They're pretty flowers. They're and gorgeous. This is made starting with sunflower honey as the base. And, you know, 71B. So this is the one that, you know, we talked about a couple months back, I want to say now, that it was just very, very light and almost flavorless. It was basically watery at 8%, which is something of an accomplishment all by itself.
Yeah, you don't get, even at 8%, you don't get that kind of wateriness, generally speaking.
But it needed something. And so I decided to go lemon meat with this. And I started with the, excuse me, I started with the zest and the juice of 3 lemons in a 3 gallon batch. So 1 lemon in a 1 gallon batch.
Yeah. Again, this is to taste. So add a little bit, taste it, let it sit for a while, taste again, add it in if you want more.
And there was not enough lemon in it. So okay. I added 6 more.
Okay, so you got 3 per gallon now.
Right, so we're talking total 9 for 3 gallons, 3 per gallon. And that got me to a pronounced lemon flavor that I liked. But still pretty dry and still a little tart. And, you know, I got to thinking, again, a while back on the show, we sampled some really interesting honeys.
Yes, we did. I remember that. We had coffee honey and a, I remember what it was now. Oh, what was it?
Lemon blossom.
Lemon blossom. Okay, yeah. Duh.
So, after I got the 9 lemons into this 3 gallon batch, I stabilized it, and then I back sweetened with 42 ounces
of lemonette,
lemon blossom honey.
Oh my gosh! And I will tell you, this smells fresh.
Yes.
Very refreshing. Very light. I like that. Oh my gosh, that's good. Now taste, dude. This is good.
Mm-hmm.
This is solid. Oh, my gosh.
It took me, I tried doing this on little, like, I think I told you before, my general rule of thumb is, you know, I don't want to do a lot of back sweetening. I started with 12 ounces of that lemon blossom honey. And I that's sweeter. Something more. My wife is like, well, you should just do another 12 ounces. What's going to hurt? If it gets a little sweeter than you usually like, you'll be fine. And I overshot and put 15 in the measuring cup. I was like, okay, fuck it. Let's just go with this. Still not enough. Well, you know, you overshot and put in another 9. Still not enough. We got to 42 ounces total. And I think
for a 3 gallon batch, that's a lot for you.
That is a
flat
lot.
Flat out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds more like my range of sweetening there, man.
That's
good.
Yeah.
It's not overly sweet.
No. And part of that is just the acidity of it. You know, there's the lemon juice, there's lemon zest, there's the lemon notes in that lemon blossom honey that balances out nicely. But it has the extra honey that I added to it. Has the also added to the body of it, so it's a little bit more like full feeling in the mouth, and that adds to the enjoyment of it too. And you know, initially I was thinking about carbonating this and making like a little fizzy lemon something or other, but I think with this level of sweetness, I'm okay with it not being carbonated.
Well, I'm not mad at all about lack of carbonation. This is good.
Yeah,
it's got a very refreshing lemon flavor. It's not It's in no way too sweet. It is the right amount of sweet.
Yeah,
And it's still 8%.
It's 8%. So and this is
there. You go, guys. I mean, whew, that's awesome.
Yeah. No, this is going to be my after mowing the lawn or like summer barbecue drinking time.
This is lemonade.
little tipsy lemonade today, but you know,
I'm an adult. Oh, that's good, man. Good job.
Thank you. And this is part of that. This is the first like swing I took at just elevating my game and making things
that much
finish better, as opposed to just like, okay, that's good.
I'm impressed and good swing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, today we talked about last time, maybe talking a little bit about beekeeping.
Yeah.
And I have heard so many people, I mean, not just people who write into us, but people in general say, hey, if you're making mead, why don't you grow bees too? It must be cheaper. Stop. I knew the answer to this. I don't have bees. I've never kept bees. I will never. I'm not afraid of bees. I've had bees in my hand. I've had bees apologize for stinging me. Which if a bee stings you and starts walking counterclockwise around the sting, it's unwinding its stinger to pull it out without damaging you and not killing itself. And it will fly away. When it's walking counterclockwise, it's apologizing. It didn't mean to do that. And if you let it be, if you let it, leave it alone, it will unwind it, it'll fly off, and you will not have a bee sting. I found this out from a beekeeper telling me, and then I got stung X amount of time later, and it worked. But bees can accidentally sting, and they can't apologize.
I've never experienced that myself. I know I have also heard from beekeepers that, like, there is that idea that, hey, here's some bee pollen. This will help with your allergies. No.
It does not.
No.
No. I've heard that. I tried that. It did not make things better.
Guys, there's a lot of different kinds of pollen out there. Some that is gathered by bees for the purposes of, like, you know, pollen. If you, we'll talk about this in the bee, like, food cycle is the protein source, right? Mm-hmm. But the plants provide the pollen because the bees go from plant to plant to plant and it fertilizes and it is there, you know, that lets them spread their genes around and get the benefits of sex, right? Mm-hmm. The pollen that's causing your fall allergies, my fall allergies, Chris's fall allergies,
and spring allergies
is wind pollinated.
Yeah.
It just blows on the wind. The bees don't care. Entirely different.
It's not helpful. Now, being as I just said, I've never kept bees. I'm never going to keep bees. I'm not afraid of bees. I like bees. I'm not allergic to bees. Jeff has kept bees.
A number of years I've tried keeping bees, and I don't currently have bees. There is a reason for that, and we'll talk about that.
Partly you have chickens.
Actually, chickens and bees coexist very nicely.
I did not know that.
Yeah, apparently. One of the major pests that I encountered as a beekeeper, we'll talk about that as we get into it. Do you want to hazard a guess as to the 3 years or so that I kept bees, how much I spent on stuff, including the bees themselves?
Well, no, but I will. But I've seen you have two hives. I've seen as many as two hives in your yard.
Three.
You had three at one point. I did not know that part. I've seen two. But I remember you talking about you had the constraints you put in it, the slat things you put in to make the honeycomb on.
The frames, yeah.
I would say $300-$400. Am I way off?
You're way off.
I'm way off. Okay, well, that's like that's the most of I've spent on mead making, so.
I would estimate, and this is a rough estimation, I probably spent about $2,000 on beekeeping stuff over the 3 years that I was trying. And bear in mind, that's also buying bees. Bees are even more expensive now than they were then. But between the woodenware, the equipment, the vest, the smoker, the tool, the hive boxes and frames and all that stuff, on top of getting bees and getting queens and getting stuff like that, a lot. And when bees are getting established in their hives, they take honey. That's not honey you can harvest. I could have harvested it, but the bees would have died, and they died anyway. But I was hoping that they were going to survive the winter and things like that. The point is,
but bees are they hard to keep alive?
Yes and no. It really depends on the context. And I don't know that suburban lawns are necessarily the best sources of nutrition for bees. Bees have a functional range of about 2.5 miles before they have to start eating the nectar that they're harvesting, and they're getting less out of their range than they could have.
So basically, a 5 mile diameter is their range.
2.5 mile diameter.
2.5 mile.
Yeah,
Okay.
that's.
I thought, if they could travel 2.5 miles one way, that would be a radius. It doesn't matter. Anyway, point is they can only go out so far without eating what they're making.
Right. And you want to hazard a guess for that $2,000 how much honey that I have actually harvested from my bees?
I'll be blunt, I never saw a single pint of honey come from any of that. I never saw a bit of it.
No. Only in the last year did I get anything out of my bees, and even then it wasn't that much. I have a bucket in my basement with maybe, I would estimate, 20 pounds of honey.
In how many years?
Three?
3 years.
$2,000 outlay.
Ooh, that's expensive honey there, buddy.
But the fun thing is, it's kind of like chickens. You can get eggs from chickens. You can get meat from chickens. That's not why I have chickens. I have chickens because chickens are just cool.
No, they're
They're fun to
fun.
watch. And
Yeah.
bees are kind of the same way for me, that I didn't approach it like, okay, I'm gonna just cut off having to buy my discount honey at Costco and have all the honey I need from my two or three little hives in my backyard. It
No.
was kind of a, I want to see what it's like having these little bugs around.
That's a
And
good attitude.
the, yeah.
But I mean, honestly, the fact that I chickens are fun because how many times have we gone to your backyard and watched chickens run around after the show,
Yeah.
after we've
And
had a half a bottle, full bottle of meat?
as much as like being a little buzzed and watching chickens run around is fun, like this is my daily like work thing of like I especially like the later part of spring into the early part of fall, I basically sit on my back porch with my laptop and watch the chickens and the dogs run. And it's great. And
You have a
it's
tough job there, buddy.
I know, right?
I got that. Okay, so, okay, $2,000, 20 pounds of honey, 3 years. Sounds like a horrible investment to me.
If what you're looking for is honey, make friends with beekeepers.
Which
Don't
I've
keep
been.
bees yourself. Don't
Okay,
keep bees yourself.
so
But
how do you keep them? Okay, when you first get bees, what's the process here?
so before you get bees, you need equipment. And realistically, just like there's homebrew clubs, there are beekeeping clubs all around the country. There's like two in the metro area alone here on the Kansas side and Missouri side. Go to your local beekeeping club. Make friends, and usually they have like a springtime beekeeping class that you can get into for dirt cheap. I think I paid $50 for the local one, maybe, and that included a book. These are usually people that are have been beekeeping for decades, and they know the ins and outs of it. And yeah, it's worth checking out.
I mean, it must sound like it'd be worth checking out, even if you're not planning to keep bees, just so you know more about it.
Well, and a number of places like the Lawrence, the Kansas side has their beekeeping organization out in Lawrence. I want to say in like sometime in between May and July, they have what they call their fun day at the Douglas County Fairgrounds, where they just do a bunch of beekeeping stuff, and it's like a county fair, like a mini county fair, and you can come out and do bee stuff and see bees, and yeah, it's that. Wholeheartedly recommend any kind of like fun day or educational day just to talk to beekeepers and hang out and see fun bee stuff. Usually this is the kind of event where like you see people doing bee beards and stupid stuff like that, and yeah, that's a great just little introduction to beekeeping for you.
Okay, what would you consider base equipment for beekeeping?
So you need your woodenware. Your hive has a few different parts. You're going to need a base for the hive where the rest of the hive sits. You're going to need boxes for your hive, and these come in a few different sizes. The first thing you got to decide when you're buying a hive, we're talking about, and without going down a rabbit hole, there's a bunch of different types of hives. I'm going to talk about the Langstroth hives, which are like the common hive you see all the time. They are the most popular hive in America, and they're the ones with the little removable frames, so it's real easy to harvest and move stuff around and things like that. There are two different like widths of or quantities, I guess you could say, for the frames and or sorry, for the boxes, and three different sizes of boxes. So, generally speaking, we talk about eights or tens,
Okay.
the number of frames you fit inside a box.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. Be honest, I never counted, so I don't have any
Sure,
clue.
sure. And then there are also different sizes of boxes, the height of the boxes, if you will. There are deeps, which are, higher. There are mediums, which are medium size. And then there's what we call supers. Generally speaking, around here, and this varies region by region, so it's really good, again, to go to your local beekeeping club and see what's normal for you guys. But around here, the prescribed kind of like how to keep bees is to have two deeps, and then anything else you put on is supers. The difference is the deeps are where the bees, like their honeycomb is for brood. It's for the baby bees to get laid and raised up from larvae and into more worker bees. The supers are where they store the excess honey. And so at the end of the year,
The super is where you get your honey.
right, that's where you harvest the excess.
Gotcha, makes sense. All right, so you need your wooden work, and that's a box, a lid, a stand.
Right. A stand, a base, your frames, and then all that stuff that's
Okay.
generally wood. There are in recent years there's you've probably seen like the flow hive
Yeah.
idea.
I'm kind of ambivalent about that. I don't know how much that saves you in effort and all that, but.
I am too. It's There is something to be said for, oh, you don't disturb the bees when you harvest the honey. Okay.
Well, yeah, but you've disturbed them because you harvested the honey, though.
All the honey cells that they packed in, they're now empty. And the bees kind of go, whoa, what the hell go? The other reason that I'm not thrilled with them is that as a beekeeper, you have to look at your bees. You have to open the hive and check on the hive and see what's going on so that you know if they need help. And this is a learning process too. I didn't get as far as I wish I had with those because my bees kept dying before I figured out what was
Killing them off.
right. Usually, more often than not, more than half of the hives that I had were getting robbed out by the hive next to
Rough, which makes Stephen's orchard, where I get a lot of my honey from for my finals, all the more impressive because he sells vast amounts of honey. I mean, 5 gallon, 5 pound jars. I mean, they're not, or he has them all the time.
In addition to that, you need your own gear. We're talking at bare minimum a veil, but a beginning beekeeper probably wants a jacket too, if not a full suit.
Okay.
You're going to need a smoker and you're going to need a hive tool.
What's a hive tool?
It looks like a little crowbar. You need a tool to separate the different parts of the box or to separate the frames from the box because, in addition to honey and pollen, the bees also harvest something called propolis.
I don't know what that is.
Propolis is made from usually it's like pine resins and other like resinous substances that the trees that they forage from, but it's kind of like a sticky glue. They'll use that to fill holes in the side of the hive. They'll use that to stick the hive boxes together. They'll use that to stick the frames to the box itself.
Kind of protect everything they have
Right.
in there. Okay,
It's
gotcha.
antimicrobial and fills holes and spaces. It's their solution to all kinds of stuff, really.
It's Beacock.
Yeah. Close as we can come to a reasonable shorthand for it,
Your
yes.
Beacock.
Beacock. But
Okay.
there are some people that swear up and down that beacock also has health benefits, and so they just eat some of
Okay, I assume
that.
they haven't died, so.
I can't imagine it tastes great. It's one of those, okay, more power to you. I'm not going to do that, but
I have no desire. I'm there for honey.
yeah. Maybe pollen. Pollen's nice at times, but
I have this mental thing about pollen. I'm allergic to, like the world.
No, I've had a few like what do I want to say? Some kind of like an avocado toast that was dusted with bee pollen,
Really?
and I felt a little energized after it. The bee
Okay,
pollen
good.
has a weird earthy flavor to it that is not necessarily like tasty, but it kind of goes okay with the avocado.
Okay, I'll have to try it sometime. I have no I've had bee pollen before. I've taken, here's a spoonful of bee pollen. Try this. I felt like I was eating a large grain of sand, I'll be honest.
It's
Wasn't sweet, wasn't tasty, but
not pleasant by itself, but you get a little You get a little buzz from it.
Stop that.
So, yeah, you want to have stuff to protect yourself. You need a bare minimum of veil so they keep away from your face. You probably want a jacket or a suit. Those are not cheap all by themselves.
Oh, I'm sure. I didn't even think about the suit when I gave my estimation. So, yeah. I mean, oh my gosh. So, above the personal protection gear, which is basically what it is.
You also want a smoker, obviously.
A smoker.
Your smoker is going to need fuel. They have, obviously, this is the capitalist economy. They have smoker fuel specifically made for it. But you know what I used more often than not?
What?
I went to the farm store, and I got, like, the cedar chips they have for, like, horse stalls.
And just lit them.
Yeah. And it's... Okay. It smells like cedar smoke.
I like cedar.
So, yeah, it smells nice. That said, on top of that, you got to buy bees. And there are two, well, actually three ways you could buy bees. But the third one is pretty iffy, if you can find it. It's a very much an if, not a when. The first way you buy bees is by what's called a package. What a package is it's a wooden frame with screen on either side. And you get in the package a can of, like, bee food. You get a queen in a cage, and you get 3 pounds of bees.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of bees.
Yeah.
Okay.
It sounds like a lot of bees.
But it's not.
You'd be surprised at, you know, how few... Well, you'd be surprised how many bees fit in 3 pounds, but... We're talking something along the lines of, it's a little bigger than a shoebox.
Okay.
Now, when you get the package of bees, basically the way you do this is you take your frame, your hive, with all the frames inside, you pull the can of bee food out of this. The bees are mostly going to stay inside. You hang the little queen cage inside, between two of the frames, and then you turn the package upside down and go chonk, 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 and knock all the bees out of it.
How mad does that make them? A little bit?
Not as mad as I would be.
Okay, well.
Still, you know, you want to be wearing a suit when you're doing this.
Okay, fair enough.
But the disadvantage, my thought has always been to this, is that, you know, unless you have established, like, honeycomb, the bees have to make that first. And, you know, remember the jars from, was it Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan or something like that you have over here?
Yeah, those white honeys
thing. Yeah. For every portion of wax that a bee makes, it takes 8 portions of honey.
Okay, so it's a lot of honey to make that
right.
frame.
A lot of their just initial forage is going into making that wax right off the bat. You know, it's like roots establishing itself. It takes a package a while to get going if you don't have a firm base. And I know a number of people, when they're making frames, they'll take like the plastic base of the frame and they'll just coat that with old wax, basically melt it and then use a paintbrush to coat it with wax.
You're basically giving them a pile of lumber to build a construction out of.
More or less, yeah. Give them something to start with so they don't have to metabolize it themselves. Right. The other way you can buy bees is with a nuke, and that's what I've always done.
A nuke.
Mm-hmm. A nuke, or a nuke is short for nucleus.
Thank you. Not to ask about that. I mean, the core. That sounds like a horrible way to buy bees.
In addition to the queen and the colony, and the advantage is when you get a package of bees, that queen that comes in the package, she didn't lay any of the eggs that became those workers. Literally, they took a queen, put her in a cage, put her in the box. They took 3 pounds of workers from any old hive in the yard of, you know, the bee package, you know.
I heard that's a bad idea.
That's why she's in the cage.
Okay.
Basically, the idea is it's going to take a day or two for the shipping company to get that package from the company that made it to your backyard. And that's a good start for the queen to get her stank, for lack of a better term, around the hive. Bees use pheromones for a lot of their communication.
I knew that part.
Mm-hmm. And so that little cage has a candy plug. Literally, it's like fondant candy. and it takes the bees a few days to chew through that to get to the queen. The idea is between that 2 or 3 days shipping, when you take that out, there's a little cover over it for the shipping part, so they can't get into the fauna sooner. You put the queen in the cage, into between a couple of the frames, pull the little cap off of it so they can get to the fondant, and it takes them another couple of days to eat that candy.
And at that time, they get used to that being their queen.
Right. They recognize her scent as, oh, this is my queen.
Okay, well.
When you buy a nucleus, you're basically buying a tiny little hive. The queen probably had something to do with at least the youngest workers in that hive. You're getting not only the queen, not only the workers, you're getting five frames drawn out. Usually they're harvesting honey and pollen and maybe propolis. And basically, you just take five frames out of the middle of your hive, you put the five nucleus frames in there.
And let it go.
Right. And they just suddenly have more space.
And
And they know
God for,
exactly what to do with that
yeah,
space.
I'm sure they do. I mean, the worker bee is a catchphrase for hard working.
Yes, exactly. And the third way you can get bees, this is rare. This is kind of a, if you're lucky, you know. Sometimes people are just retiring or decide they have too many hives and say, hey, I have a hive.
You don't
Who
want
wants to buy my hive?
it? Oh man.
Now, wow, bees have gotten pricey. A package, last time I checked, was running about 150 bucks
For a hive?
for a package.
Okay.
The nucleus, the five frames, the queen and the bees ran closer to 200.
Okay.
I've heard 400 to 500 for just like a one or two deep hive.
Was way off. I was way off.
And they go up every year because we've like in recent years especially, we've had some bad years for bees.
Oh, yeah.
And it's worse up here where the winters are harsher. A lot of the companies that make the packages or the nukes and things like that, they're actually out in like, you know, Texas, Louisiana, Arizona, New Mexico, where they don't really have like a freezing temperature where the bee can no longer fly kind of time. They have a, there's a lot more stuff to forage. There's a lot less stuff to forage time.
Okay,
So.
gotcha. So, wow, that's this is why beekeeping is not a cheap way to get honey.
Right. And that's not a, even on top of like all the different hazards your bees can face, because there are a bunch of different things. The main like speculative cause for why bees are dying so badly in recent years is something called Varroa destructor. It's a little mite that attaches itself to the bee between its little scales and just drinks its blood, hemolymph. But it also can convey things like deformed wing virus, so they can't fly very well. They get smaller. They're known to affect like the larvae in, as well, so the larvae don't grow well. There's a lot of problems with the Varroa, and to the point where, you know, up in Minnesota, they're actually growing bees that are like resistant to it. But there are other things like foulbrood, which is just a it's a disease you get. American foulbrood being one of the worst of them, where there is no cure for it, and the spores for foulbrood are easy to spread. So the only
Of course
way,
they are.
if your hive gets foulbrood, American foulbrood, you know what the fix is?
Burn the hive?
Exactly.
Oh my
That's
gosh,
the
I was kidding.
that's all you can do is burn your hive.
That's horrible.
Yeah, and beekeepers need more love because they go through a lot of work for this.
Beekeepers need a lot of
And
love for a while.
realistically, for our audience, I'm not saying don't keep bees, but keep bees because you're interested in bees, not because you're interested in getting cheaper honey. You're not going to get cheaper honey unless you can invest in like a serious 20 hive operation, and you've got like farmland that you can space those out on where they have plenty of forage. Because oh my gosh.
Holy cow, that's oh yeah. If you want to get cheap honey, go to a place that you're like, I went to a place 2 3 days ago called Restaurant Depot. It's a restaurant supply house. You have to have certain passes and things to get into the building. It's worse than Sam's Club. It's worse than Costco. But I went in there. And we were went in the very end of the day. I mean, they closed at 6 in the evening. I got there at 5:45. I mean, they were literally packing everything and they went to go home. I walked in because I needed honey. because I'm going to start a new batch here fairly soon. Well, my meads are done. I'm going to bottle them soon. And I need more honey. I walk in. My wife says, hey, look to your left. Hey. After this 15th or 16th, hey, I turned and I look over to the clearance section. There were 3 cases plus 4 bottles, 6 in a case, of honey. Half price.
Damn.
It was generally the case of 30 pounds cost me 52 and change. All 3 2/3 cases that were in this on this rack were 50% off because every single one of them had crystallized fully. There was no liquid honey in the bottle that I could see. To me, that is absolutely nothing. In case you ever get crystallized honey, anywhere you get honey, warm it up. Put it in a water bath, put it in your stove, let it heat up. It will liquefy into honey without harms.
As my previous co-host Ryan said a time or two, I have a drill. So crystallized honey just means it is less likely to drip as I'm moving it from the bucket to my fermenter.
There you go. And the honey is not harmed by the crystallization process. It simply got crystallized.
Right.
So I managed to get 110 pounds of honey for under $100.
Dude.
If I would have went the next morning like I was planning to, I wouldn't have been there.
I'm sure.
It wouldn't have been there. I mean, kudos to my wife for saying, we can make it, let's go. And we made it, left at 5:30, got there 15 minutes later. Traffic was a bear. And she goes, left. And I got a great deal. Keep your eye out. Someplace like that, they will occasionally, they don't want to deal with crystallized honey. And they may cut you a deal. Yeah. I mean, this is just personal experience. It's the first time it's ever happened to me. But there you go. I mean, it was authentic, actual, unmodified, real honey at $26 a case.
Sick.
It was, and I'm sitting here. I'm going to tell very few people I'm around and everybody who can't get to me.
So, Chris, do you want to take a hazard as to why I don't keep bees anymore?
The expense and the output?
No.
Why?
Bees are fascinating. I will keep bees even if I'm getting nothing out of it.
Okay, fair enough.
The problem is my bees died. And getting replacement bees is a time-sensitive kind of thing.
You only get it certain times a year?
Mm-hmm.
When?
New packages or nukes come out the late part of April to the early part, to middle of May, maybe like the last couple shipments come out like the first week or two of June.
So we're looking, we just missed it then, as of this episode.
You would think, right?
Yeah.
Except that's when they get shipped, not when you have to buy them. Because the producers of these guys need to know how many they're making, and they have a ballpark estimate of how many they can make.
Fair enough.
The bee packages and nukes go on sale basically the first week or two of January.
We're way past that point.
Right. And at that point, I'm like, oh, God, I've been way too generous at Christmas this year. I have no cash and need to be good. No, I can't afford $200 per hive for more bees.
So if I would happen to buy you a nucleus of bees or a nuke of bees, you'd do something with it?
I'd have to find a spot in my yard for it, but yeah, happily I would.
Okay.
You can see right there, I have a stack of metal woodenware that probably needs cleaned up, but, you know, if we wanted to...
I could feasibly say I'm going to give you a late Christmas present then, because you're my buddy and you like bees. You know, you like all kinds of... I mean, you and I both like all kinds of... I like bats, snakes, spiders, mm-hmm. and, you know, octopus, bees. I like, you know, but you like octopus, bees, and specifically because of the intelligence, hive intelligence and the intelligence, and because of the fascinating behavior they represent. And I've noticed that with you over the years. Mm-hmm. So I would have no problem giving you a hive so you can enjoy it.
That'd be fun. I'd appreciate that. And, you know, we talked before about chickens, right?
Yeah.
Actually, the first year that I kept bees, the little bastards that made the biggest mess of my hives were small hive beetle. They look like tiny little black beetles, maybe like the size of a grain of rice.
Okay.
And they lay their eggs in the wax. The larvae go through it and cause all kinds of damage. And then they fall out of the hive. They get into the dirt to pupate into the beetle itself. And then they like fly back into the hive. Chickens apparently are a great like cohabitant for, you know, bee yards.
They'll eat the beetles.
Right. They'll eat the larvae out of the soil.
Nice. So now you have chickens.
Well, now I have chickens and I just need bees.
Well, they have to, it's not going to be soon.
No.
Because we're well into June now.
Yeah. Yeah. This is
almost in July. So that was a bit later thing. But, yeah. Okay. You talked about the dangers of things, you know, the mites and the beetles and all that. Other than the American mites?
American foul brood, Varroa destructor, small hive beetle. There's wax moths. There's European foul brood.
What can you do to prevent that?
You need to learn what you're doing. You need to learn to look at your bees. And you basically need to, you know, give yourself however long it takes, maybe 15 minutes, maybe a half hour per hive per week to say, okay, I'm going to crack open the hive. I'm going to take a quick look. You know, the more often than not, when I was looking at my hives to make sure everything was going okay, I wasn't looking for the queen herself, but I was looking for evidence of the queen. You don't need to see the queen to know that the queen is healthy. But if you look at the frames, you can look into the frame and you can see itty-bitty little eggs or larvae mm-hmm. in the frame. That means the queen has been doing her thing within the last 2 days. The queen's there.
Okay, cool. So you know she's healthy.
Right, exactly. You look at the brood pattern on your frame. So if your frame is like basically covered over with capped brood, which looks different than capped honey, you just kind of have to...
You learn.
I'm not going to talk about it on the show. You look it up on Google.
And you'll learn.
Right. You learn. If it's covered and there's like maybe one or two gaps per side of the frame, you're fine. She's doing great. If it's kind of spotty and it looks like... It looks like badly pixelated and kind of like there's a bunch of different holes all over the place. Either A, that's capped brood that is about to hatch and has been hatching, or B, the queen is failing and you need to replace her.
I can only imagine how hard it is to replace a queen.
Well, you need to get a good queen to replace her, and then you need to find the old queen. And you know what you do with the old queen?
Kill her. Ugh. That's just sad.
I've only done that once. And my wife decided for the regicide that she should provide an appropriate instrument for that. So she got one of her fanciest pumps to do the squish.
Okay, well. Okay, horrible, but okay, gotcha. Yeah, break my heart.
It's not easy. It's not fun. But, you know, the queen dies or the hive dies, really, at the end of the
day. Gotcha. So, and you have to introduce it the same way as you dig out the weed in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah. Pond it in a cage.
Mm-hmm. Usually about 5 days is about how long the contact takes before the bees go, okay, this is the stank of my queen.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, okay, the only real take I get from all of this is I don't want to raise bees. Not for honey. I mean, I don't want to spend the time and effort to try to make honey for mead this way.
Right.
I'll leave it to professionals.
Mm-hmm. And this is probably as in-depth or more so a hobby than, you know, making mead all by itself is. So this is not something you want to get into just for some cheap money. But hey, you know, there are also all kinds of resources available online if you're interested in beekeeping. One of my favorites that I discovered like in the last year is a guy named David Burns on YouTube has a really fantastic, like weekly series that he does on, you know, just, hey, it's this time of the year and it's time for you to do this. And, you know, hey, you need to check your entrances. It's time for fall. This is what you want to do in this time and the other, like, it's very topical for the time that
he's. And it's step by step, it sounds like.
Yeah, more or less. And he is like a certified master beekeeper. He's been doing it for decades, I think. So, you know, plus I just like his attitude. He's very upbeat and, you know, chill guy. So I kind of go, okay, well, no, I can vibe with that.
Okay, well, The other thing I wanted to talk about this, you know, before we do, back to mead.
Yeah.
Heard of a new thing, and you brought it up to me. It was a sour mead. I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah. So sour meads were kind of like buttressing against sour beers, right? And there are, you know, fruited sours and things like that that are real popular. And it's not like everybody's favorite, but there's a popular segment of the, you know, the beer drinking public that's like, oh yeah, no, I want a guava sour beer. And how do you think you get sourness?
I have no clue. I mean, only thing I know for sour, I mean, what they use for sour in like candies is just citric acid. And I don't know if that works with mead.
You're not too far off. I mean, you can, you know, there's sourness in the lemon mead of mine that we were drinking earlier, right?
And but I have never heard of a sour mead prior to you telling me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, in my vast amounts of spare time I had the last couple of weeks, I didn't have time to look it up. So
this is an idea that
came from... Is this like sour candy?
Kind of, sort of. The idea is that we're adding a pronounced amount of lactic acid to a brew.
I thought lactic acid was more of like a milky mouthfeel type thing.
You're thinking of lactose.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Lactose sugar. Lactic acid is usually from bacteria strains. Now, the easiest way to make a sour something using lactic acid is just to add lactic acid, and you can get lactic acid at the homebrew store because there are a few different processes like, you know, dry hopping and things like that that will respond differently to acid levels.
Sure. Okay.
But generally speaking,
can you get this at Bacchus?
We can get this Bacchus. Yeah.
Okay, great.
I believe you can get all of this at Bacchus still. For a while though, there are ideas like making sour beers that we can kind of buttress against. So one of the most popular ways to do this for a long time was something called kettle sour. You helped me make a beer months ago.
Yes, I did. I remember that. And how did it turn? I mean, I don't drink beer, but how did it turn out?
I'm about to bottle it.
Okay, good.
I'm slow at that, but well, I'm about to bottle our Party Gale. The stronger beer that I'm making is still sitting on it.
By the way, if anybody wants, we don't stress about time when bottling, because ironically, when we have something properly contained, we can wait. We call it, I mean, for wine, I call it batch aging.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can, you know, you can be patient about this. If something comes up in your life and it takes time to get back to it, you can do that.
I've gone through a couple iterations on Hungarian oak. It's still not as oaky as I would like it, and I'm trying to just keep the oak fresh and moving. But
okay.
I started it in the spring with the intention that I would drink it in the fall. So we're still basically on track. But okay. Basically.
So kettle.
Kettle souring.
Souring.
We had a mash step in there where we were holding the grains at like 150 degrees-ish,
yeah. Right?
And then we would raise it up to about 170 to get all that sugar rinsed out. And then we boiled it to, you know, add the hops and sterilize and things like that. Between that, the mash out and the boiling, in the kettle souring process, you can add a bacterial culture. Generally, it's Lactobacillus or Pediococcus. And you'll let that sit at a prescribed temperature, usually a day or two.
Okay, I personally know how to keep a temperature level for if I'm heating meat for any reason whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I put it on the heat mats, gardening heat mats, and set a temperature.
Basically, yeah.
Is it the same way?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just put it in your fryer, do the same thing. If you're moving it from your kettle or your meat-making container into a fermenter that you're heating up, you probably will need to like thoroughly clean your container because bacteria wants to keep going, obviously.
Bacteria is bacteria.
But yeah, the idea of kettle souring is that this happens in the kettle. You, between the mash out phase and the boil phase, you let this bacteria sit for a day or two. It turns a bit of that beer into lactic acid. And then you boil it, you kill all that bacteria. After the mash cools, then you pitch your yeast, your Saccharomyces, and it does the fermenting.
And it stays that sourness that you set up.
That lactic acid can't go anywhere.
Okay. What temperature do you want to keep it at when you're souring?
It depends on the strain. You can buy Lactobacillus culture. You can buy Pediococcus culture. Those are all things you can get at Bacchus still, I think.
If not, they'll probably get it if you need it.
Yes, they can at least order them from places like Omega or High Yeast or Lalvin or whoever. Yes, absolutely. The cool thing is, since the last time we talked about making sour meads on this show ages ago with my former co-hosts, the yeast manufacturing companies have been doing all kinds of wild shit.
Because they're generally bored.
I don't know about that, but they're definitely in the interest of making things easier for us.
I appreciate that.
So, like we were talking about before, if I'm going to put my mead into a fermenter and I'm going to let a lacto culture or a pedio culture sit on it for a day or two, and then I'm going to move it into a kettle and I'm going to heat it to boil it to kill that culture, the fermenter has to be very well clean because those cultures want to come back, right?
Fair.
There are new yeasts that have been developed. Yeasts you can find at Bacchus. I know you can find at Bacchus. Things like Billy Sour, Sour VCA. Omega has their new Voss hybrid that is, I'm hoping, they're going to release on the homebrew market. They've only got on the homebrew market right now, called like Tortuga or something like that. These are yeasts that have been genetically modified to include a strain that makes its own lactic acid.
That's an interesting dance right there, chemically speaking.
Mm-hmm. It does the usual yeast thing of making alcohol, right? But
that slight pause you may have heard a moment ago that Jeff will edit some of it out is actually, I'm finishing off the last of the pineapple habanero meat he's brought up because it's good enough and not spicy enough that I'm enjoying it. I'm helping finish the bottle. If you have any clue how good this is.
It's a solid one. And this is if a summer sipper if I've ever heard it. Oh, generous of you, sir.
Oh, no. It's least I can do. This is... The words coming out, I'm drinking a habanero-flavored mead is so alien, it actually feels funny on my tongue.
So, yeah, this came up because, like, you know, we talked about my ambition for the mead I want to make for June being like a grapefruit with some lavender and some tequila notes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
July, I think, is going to be a sour.
Okay.
So,
just to let you know, my cat just yesterday told me she would like me to make a coconut grapefruit mead.
That could be interesting.
It's a pom. It's in bar terms, it'd be a Pomona.
Paloma?
Paloma. Sorry, Paloma.
Well, this the Paloma is the grapefruit and tequila that I was talking about with the lavender. It was a lavender Paloma that we had on vacation that really inspired that one.
Well, so she wanted me to do a coconut, basically Paloma.
Okay.
So
you've already got the coconut rum.
I've already got the coconut rum. And here we go. If I just get that friggin' peanut butter going. Anyway, so you're talking sour.
Yeah. No, the yeast have been specifically like modified crossbred or whatever so that they also include a pathway to make the lactic acid that you would otherwise need a bacteria strain for. So it's a single strain. It does all the work in one stop. And it still responds to the same like metal bisulfite and sorbate that we use to kill the yeast at the end of our ferment. Okay. Very like from a, you know, cross-contamination and just keeping things nice and easy going, very clean. So
okay, now I want to bring this up because we didn't really address it directly last time. We talked about my son's mead.
Mm-hmm.
He cooked up to 125, 130 degrees Fahrenheit
right.
for like 15 minutes. That's probably enough. What is enough time?
I'm not sure that there is a direct answer on that, but I know that the USDA has a chart they use for milk pasteurization that assumes ambient pressure, right? Like air pressure, not under, high temperature, like a pressure cooker or something like that in an industrial process. But that will tell you how long it needs to be for what temperature, for example. And I know for some cases, it's something like 5 or 10 minutes under 165 or something like 20 to 30 minutes under 145. At 125, I'm not sure if that's possible in the first place, but I think that's in the neighborhood of an hour.
Okay, well, the reason he said 125, 30 was he found out that yeast it starts dying at 125, 130. They're only about 130.
Yeah, but they are resilient little bastards, though.
Yeah, but, you know, again, the meat he made for us wasn't bad.
No.
And it wasn't bubbly. So if there's active yeast in there, it'll just have to be killed in my tummy. By the way, one of his best friends has asked for a bottle because he wants to enjoy the experiment. Back to sour.
Yeah, no. So there are a couple of ideas that I'm highlighting here. Obviously, Philly Sour is one of the strains that you can get at Bacchus. The Sour Vicia is the other one. And I'm not sure which one I want to use. I think the Sour Vicia actually has more, like, is more specifically, like, lactic acid producing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what other flavors I want to throw into this. Obviously, it's going to be something fruity. Probably something tropical fruity. Maybe, based on what little we have left of this,
yes,
we're going to smoke or char some pineapple and throw some sour in there. And
you were there, but I mean, my first pineapple, grilled pineapple wine.
Yeah, it was my grill. We grilled it
all. Exactly. I mean, and that came out pretty stellar, to be honest.
Yeah, no. The grilled pineapple works. I've got a smoker. I've got a little, like the little thin gauge racks for fruit and veggies and stuff like that I've used in the past. By the way, last fall I discovered something. Acorn squash smokes really goddamn nicely.
What's the flavor? Do you know?
Squashy, but also smoky. I use pecan chips on it.
Okay, that would make a lot of difference.
And my wife is not particularly like adventurous when it comes to flavor. She tried some of that. I was like, oh, you need to make this again.
Okay, nice. But I was thinking making a one day making a pumpkin meat, and you were going to use sweet potatoes for part of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's butternut squash. It's my suggestion.
Butternut squash, I was saying.
Just because it's a little bit more intense in the flavor components and tastes very, very comparable. Some people claim they can tell the difference. I'm not sure I believe
that. If they can do it, that's their whisper.
Right.
So we use the what is the souring?
Well, the yeast has been engineered now to produce lactic acid.
Yes. So, I'm not a huge sour person. I don't mind a little bit of sour. That's mm-hmm. fine. Obviously, I eat grapefruit, so yeah. But is this like if you're getting a sweet sour candy type? You can even do that kind of thing.
Yeah. No, you've heard me talking about the idea of like a sweet tart mead, right?
Yeah.
This is pushing the tart part. My anticipation is we're also going to push the sweet tart to make both more intense.
Okay.
Product. So
this could be potentially belly button puckering sour. Okay. Don't know how. I'll try it. I mean, I'll be able to speak afterwards, but
beware. I have created the black hole of sourness. It will turn you inside out.
It might. But okay, so for those who love sour, which I'm not a member of that society, I don't mind a little bit of sour, but a lot of sour is it's tough.
We're getting into summertime.
This
is the, you know, we're talking citrus, we're talking sour. This is the time for it if there isn't.
Yeah, if there isn't, there isn't one.
And I think, you know, this is also a great time to get pineapple for as cheap as you're going to get it during the year, realistically.
I actually saw a place at the River Market downtown. They had many pineapple plants for sale.
Nice.
It was from the botany. I can't remember the name of the botanist that they have the Venus flytraps and the pitcher plants and now many pineapple plants.
Cute.
One of them was actually ripening on the vine, right? I was sitting here, as I get berries out of their minis, I'm sitting here, how long did it get there? About a year and a half. And they're in the cave. I'm sitting here, dude, that's not much pineapple for the result there.
No.
It was a little bigger than a softball, but I'm not mad. It was awesome to see. It really was. But, you said that lactic acid was one way. Mm-hmm. Is there another?
Generally, all of these roots are producing lactic acid, whether it's like the chemical bottle of lactic acid you get at Bacchus or a
lactic acid developing
yeast. Right, a bacteria or a yeast. Lactic acid is the way to make sour because lactic acid is a strong sour flavor.
Okay,
more so than citric or malic or something like that. So it takes a little to get a lot, if you will.
On that note, how can you control the adjustment of sour to sweet in your mix? So it, when you have the bacteria yeast.
That's the question. I think it's a selection kind of thing. If I remember right, Philly sour as a yeast produces less of it than the Sauerficiae. And kind of the idea is it's a certain, amount of sour is being produced compared to amount of alcohol being produced, right? This is probably experimentation at this point, because if you're doing kettle souring, this is the upside to kettle souring. You get enough lactic acid in there,
You can just stop the whole thing.
you just, okay, time to boil. Now we'll put the beer yeast in.
Okay. So, as far as control goes, you think the kettle souring method is better for just the control if you want it?
Right. If you want to do that to taste and figure out exactly how much sourness you need, yeah, that is the way to do that in two separate steps. If you're going to do a clean ferment and you don't want to have to worry about, I have heard some people say that, like, look, if you're going to do sour meats, or you're going to do like the, either like the lactobacillus or pediococcus or whatever kind of secondary infection kind of stuff, you have to have separate equipment for that,
Okay,
because
fair.
otherwise it's just going to stay infected.
And that leads to the question, what separate equipment do you need?
Bare minimum, like if you're using bucket fermenters, buckets, probably auto siphon, anything that's not glass. Glass is pretty easy to clean unless it's scratched, right? But anything plastic, you probably need a one for your bacteria, one for
Yeast.
your yeast.
Okay, fair. Now, this is important because if somebody out there wants to do this, I wouldn't even have the information they need here for
For
this.
sure, for sure.
So the separate kettle thing is another bucket. So how would you bring that? Would you like to use a sous vide to bring it up temperature to kill it off, or?
You could also just, transfer it to an actual kettle, take it on your stovetop and bring it to a boil.
Okay, and that shouldn't take that long to kill the bacteria at that point.
Once you get into the boiling temperatures, I think the, kills yeast or kills bacteria temperature is like, we're measuring in seconds, if not a minute or two.
Okay, so it's not long.
No, not at all.
Okay, that's
The bitch, of course, is that, if we're bringing stuff to a boil and we're making a yeast, we're also killing all of those volatile organics in the honey that make it nice. So
yeah.
you're talking about probably wanting to back sweeten even more now that we're missing
Again,
those.
fair. I mean, back sweetening to me is more of a how I feel at that moment, back sweetening things. I mean, I know it's not scientific. I could back sweeten and measure specific gravity, but I mostly back sweeten to the part where, okay, I like that.
Right.
That's solid.
The
And I back off.
back sweetening is more artistic than science to me too. It's a, how does this play with this? How does this taste this? I mean, I measured the amount I was putting in here. I didn't measure the final gravity after it was
In your
done,
lemon, you
right,
said,
in
yeah.
this lemon that we were talking about earlier,
Which
because
I'm going to finish before we leave, by the way, just letting you
I
know.
was going to let you have this to take home to your wife, actually.
If I have to.
Well,
Okay, well,
she'll
I love
worry.
my wife, so yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, so now the question I'm can we make a Warhead Sour Patch Kid mead at this point?
Why not? Yeah.
Holy cow, I mean that. Okay, I don't enjoy that level of sour personally. This is just me. But just to let people that are listening know, that's amazing. We can make a Sour Patch Warhead level sour mead adult drink.
Can we get that sour? Maybe, I don't know. I mean,
We could approach it.
those we could damn well try, and we'd give it a fair shot.
Okay.
I remember at one point, like right out of college, I had an entire thing of those extreme warheads that I took to
Oh
work one
my
day,
gosh.
and I went through the entire thing,
The
and just
faith
like
collapsing sour.
my I felt over the surface of my teeth with my tongue, was like, do my teeth feel like sandpaper now? Do they? Did I eat away all the enamel? Those.
Mean I mean the ones that I've seen across the internet for months now, those black candy, the sourest candy on God's green earth that people get so go into convulsions. And as a joke, meat, I might do that because I'm mean like that. And I, you know, from the outside looking in, that'd be funny as all get out to me.
1 gallon at a time.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, if that. I mean, I may do a half gallon on that one. But, oh, man, that's the possibilities for both, you know, flavor and just for fun just open up right there. I'm not sure how much I, so, okay, so you can kettle, and that's the one you can control how much your sour is best.
Right, right, right. You can kind of taste that as you go and say, okay, that's enough sour for me.
Okay, that's fair enough. And the other one is you're kind of playing the dice of what the manufacturer designed it for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
I can't imagine they're not going to say that's enough at this point.
Realistically, I've got to imagine that they've selected these strains to produce this amount for. Granted, they're making sour beers with this, not sour mead, and we're probably looking at doing a sweet component to this that we're not going to find in a sour beer.
Right, yeah, fair, fair.
But it's got to be relatively palatable, I would think.
You know? Absolutely. So now, it's another experiment yet to do. So, and I've actually been asked recently by a member of Slaps Barbecue here in Kansas City to make a pineapple mead.
Nice.
She would like to try pineapple mead.
So okay. Well,
here we go with it. I mean, like I said, the five batches I've got going right now need to be bottled. And once I get that done, I have to start something else. So since I've got, you know, blah, 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 a number of buckets.
This lemon mead is, well, it just got back sweetened. I was really hoping it would clear up on its own. It's not really.
It's not super clear, but, you know, here's my hazy plum.
I'm fiddly enough that I will throw some dual fine in it and make sure it stays stabilized before I go bottling it, but it's bottled within the week.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I did with my wild plum. I said, that's pretty cloudy. I mean, I filter it through the number one filter. Mm-hmm. Still, that haziness you saw was after the number one filter.
Right, yeah. I don't know how you managed that.
It's magic. I whispered poorly or something. I don't know, but it was magic. But I was briefly deciding whether I wanted to do a number two filter, but it tastes good. And it's not meant for market or anything, so I'm thinking I'm
pretty good. You're not going to sell it. Are you going to send it to competition?
No, probably not.
Are we going to drink it?
Yeah.
I don't think we care.
No, it tastes good. It's all I really care about is my mead.
Yeah, so
I'm kind of done with my process on that. I mean, I threw the enzyme, the peptic enzyme in there to see if it clear up any. I didn't notice the difference, to be honest, after 48 hours. It will take
some time. Well, after 48 hours, you're going to see the difference one way or the other. So, okay, yeah, maybe it's just going hazy.
And, you know, I think one of the best comments I had, a friend of mine looked at me and says, hey, yeah, solid is hazy, wild plum, and double the price. I said, I don't sell. But anyway, we appreciate you coming with us and joining us on our journey here. Sour mead. I mean, you know, if you want a beekeep, I know that was a big chunk of what we did here, but look for a bargain, I did.
Yeah, no. Support your local beekeepers. They're doing a lot. They're
working hard.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, God, you know, we talked last week about planting stuff in containers.
Yeah. If you want to, great. Support your local farmer's market.
Right. If you're going to plant stuff, hey, you know, fruit bushes, things like that aren't a bad choice for bees either for that.
Yeah, I mean
if you have a space on your land, plant a flowering tree.
Yeah, and the bees will love you and you can help them out.
You know, little stuff like sage or salvia, things like that, that have a ton of little flowers.
Or even milkweed for the monarchs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of things we do to help our environment. But for as far as mead, help out the people who do this as a job.
Right. They have the volume and the experience to do it for you. So,
I mean, I'm convinced that Missouri and Kansas farmers could grow a popsicle on a fence post if they actually wanted to. Because I've seen them do some unbelievable things with how they grow things. But nonetheless, you know, when you're making your mead, make it a community, not an individual effort.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah. And you're probably going to come out for the better for it because... Make a friend, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You know, you have a friend.
Yeah. Well, this talk has run ridiculously long, so maybe we should wrap this up here. Chris, great to have you out.
Take care. Thanks for the mead.
Mm-hmm. We'll see you next week, guys.